Thank you, brother. Good word. Attention to detail is very important. It's what sets good quality product apart from junk. Just imagine a piece of furniture, a house, or a vehicle, or a truck, or any kind of piece of equipment. If the manufacturer doesn't pay attention to detail, who's going to be impressed with that? Details matter. And these small things, I'm not so sure if these are small things that the brother mentioned here. These are not small things. These are actually very important details of the Christian life. They are important. And if we were not faithful in these little things, who will give us or entrust us with greater things? Who will? Nobody will. And one thing we need to understand that there is a process in backsliding. And that process starts when we don't give attention to detail. And every action has a consequence. And if you start ignoring the details, pretty soon these details turn into big details. These details become mountains. So, yeah, we need to be careful. We need to be careful about the details, especially in our Christian life. So, yeah, good word. But I'm going to continue here with my studies here. And we find ourselves this week in... the next chapter here is... In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, I left out this chapter. It's about marriage, what our duty is, the couples one to another, about virgins, about everything to do with marriage. So I'm not into marriage counseling. And I'm not sure Paul should have been either. Because he didn't have a wife. And that's maybe why some of these verses, you know, he put you in a tailspin. Especially this one that really puts me in a spin. And that's verse 14 of chapter 7, where it says, "For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Else were their children unclean, but now they are holy." So if two unbelieving parents have children, their children are unholy and unclean. But if even one of them is a believer, it sanctifies them. I mean, that puts me in a spin. I don't really know what he's talking about. And if somebody has better clarity than that, he better speak up. So I skip this chapter. And the next one is not much easier. There's also, there were two questions raised, and you can see it by just the way he started the chapter 7. He said, "Concerning those things he wrote to me about." So he was getting questions from this Corinthian church, and he addressed at least a couple of them here in chapter 7. And number 8, he addressed another one. So we're going to read that one and talk about chapter 8 this morning. And I titled my message, "Rights, Freedoms, and Self-Discipline." So, chapter 8. "Now as touching things offered unto idols, we know that we all have knowledge." Knowledge puffs up. but charity edifies. And if any man think that he know anything, he know nothing yet as he ought to know. But if any man love God, the same is known of him. As concerning therefore the eating of those things which are offered in sacrifice unto idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is none other God but one. For though there be that are called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as there are gods many and lords many, but to us there is but one God, the Father, to whom are all things, and we in him, and one Lord Jesus, by whom are all things, and we by him. Howbeit, there is not in every man this knowledge. For some, with conscience of the idol unto this hour, eat it as a thing offered unto an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. But meat commended us not to God, for neither if we eat are we the better, or neither if we eat not are we the worse. But take heed lest by any means this liberty of yours becomes a stumbling block for them that are weak. For if any man see thee which hath knowledge sit at the meat in the idol's temples, shall not the conscience of him which is weak be emboldened to eat those things which are offered to idols? And through thy knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died. But when ye sin so against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, ye sin against Christ. Therefore, if meat make thy brother to offend, I will eat no flesh while the world standeth, lest I make my brother to offend. May God bless the reading of his word. And this eighth chapter here, just like the seventh chapter, it is a second question that was raised by and asked the apostle in a letter. And it has to do with a problem that is very common in Christians' lives today. A problem that doesn't have much to do with what we have today, this particular one. Because I don't think anybody had a problem this week with going and eating meat that was offered to idols. But how much should we let other people's views control our actions? That's the question. Must we limit our liberties by the narrower, more restricted views of some other Christians? What is the answer? Paul tries to address this here, and he shows us what is more important. And we recognize immediately that what these Christians are facing is different, but then again it's similar. Because we are faced with the same things much the same way. And the question is, how much should we adjust our actions accordingly? So yes, we don't get faced with eating meat offered to idols. I'm sure nobody struggled with that in the last while. But the answer that the apostle gives is a principle. It's a principle that can be applied to so many different areas of our life. And when these disagreements or arguments crop up. So the best place to buy a good roast or a good steak in Corinth was right next to the idol temple. And these were pagan temples. And they did like the Jews did in the Old Testament. They offered animal sacrifices. They Some meat was reserved for the priests and some for public sale. And so yeah, there was meat being sold as and it had been offered to idols, and people were buying it, and some of the Christians at Corinth were buying it and eating it, and others were having a problem with it. And everybody knew it. Therefore, this question arose: if a Christian eats meat offered to idols, is he not partaking in some way in the worship of idols? There was the one group who says, yes, that is exactly what they're doing. These are pagans here in the city, and we know what's going on. And there are Christians here sitting and eating this meat that was offered to idols, and we think this person is going along with these pagan ideas. As a consequence, that Christian is giving a false testimony. This was the first group. And not clearly declaring that Christ has done away with all those sacrifices, and furthermore, he is causing to stumble the weak Christians who might easily get back to worship of an idol by these actions. That's the first group. And then there's then the second group. He said, no, that's not true. There is nothing to an idol that doesn't exist. It's just a fictional thing, a piece of wood or stone that somebody carved out. It's really no God, and how can you worship something that really doesn't exist? It means nothing to me, and by going and showing these heathens that there's these idolatrous ways don't mean anything to me, because they are not there. There's nothing to them, and it is better that we simply proceed according to the knowledge and the reality that God has brought us in Christ. Let us enjoy our freedom. Eat this meat without question. It's perfectly good. And therefore comes the division. Excuse me. So we recognize immediately that this problem is still very common in the church today. Actually, we're not so very far removed from these very issues. Because I know some Christians who will not celebrate Christmas because they believe it to be a pagan holiday, and to observe it will be participating in idol worship. Though it can be, and it is in Western civilization, a lot is idol worship. We know why we do it. But we should be pointing out to people who get troubled by these kinds of things that they're going to have to be consistent. Because just about every name of the days of the week are because of a name of a pagan god. There was the Sunday, which was the sun god, and the moon was Monday, and Thor was a god of the Romans, and they named Thursday after that, and the list goes on. And are we going to not see Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday anymore because of some heathen god it's named after? And the same way as with most of the months are named after pagan names. January is named after a Roman god, the two-faced god who looks backwards to the old year and forward to the new. That's what January means. Are we now no longer going to say January because of the pagan god? I mean, the argument is pretty senseless, I think. But that's basically along the same lines that was going on in Corinth. And March is addressed and dedicated to Mars, the god of war for the Greek. And we can go through many more of these scenarios in our modern day and terms that have pagan origin. Does that make us partakers of pagan worship? I don't think so. And because they're no longer a problem for us, we can also see how this principle could have been very difficult right at the beginning. And the churches that Paul started, they were the beginning. And this is what they were wrestling with at Corinth. But we have to notice how Paul handles it. He recognizes these two groups, and there was the Freedom Party. Common term these days, freedom. Freedom Party, who boasts of their knowledge, because he says in verse 1, all of us possess knowledge. And he's just simply repeating what the Freedom Party was saying. Everyone knows that an idol is nothing. There is one God. Nothing real about this idol. Pieces of wood and stone. And if we eat this meat, we are not worshiping these pagan deities. They don't even exist. Paul recognized that knowledge is right. First of all, he acknowledged them, yes, that is true. There is only one true God, and for us, it is one God, one Father, and for all our, and for whom of all things and for whom we exist. Yes, that is true. The argument, of course, is simply that the knowledge of these people caused something else. And he suggests that there's a problem with that. He says, knowledge puffs up. And usually that's what it does. Knowledge puffs up. And we recognize, although we might not have this meat-eating problem today, there are similar problems. Many parallel issues that we could take this very same principle and apply. Some Christians are disturbed with a matter of drinking alcohol in any form. Any form. They have knowledge and they puff themselves up and say, well, I've no problem. All the while, ignoring everybody else. What about keeping the Sabbath? Same issue. There's a lot of issues that divide. And that's what they're designed to do, divide. So how do we settle? How do we settle them? Well, Paul says their knowledge is right. What they're arguing is correct, but that knowledge has a problem, and that it puffs up. It creates pride and makes us feel superior. That's the first problem. And if that's what it does, it actually is a problem. You only have to listen to some of the arguments that are being waged in our current day. And we see how true that is. Whoever can whoever is the loudest or the most knowledgeable in a situation or more forceful, you can see it right away. It's already under their head. It doesn't matter what side you're on. If you're on the liberal side or the restricted side, knowledge tends to create that sense of pride. And nobody wants to let go of that. Everybody wants to keep their own and force their own opinion, and no matter what everybody else says. Some would say, look at those worldly Christians. I would not do some of the things that they do. And then on the other hand, we have those we hear that freedom and liberty talk. You say, oh, those legalists. Why don't they move out of the 19th or the 18th century? Why don't they grow up? Don't they realize that we are free to take all these restrictions don't apply? So knowledge creates pride, and pride is always a problem. And will always bring contention, because the Word of God said only by pride comes contention. There's no doubt about it. It puffs us up and makes us feel superior. And those who are still limited by certain restrictions, well, we are better than they are. Paul goes on to say that he who thinks like this, thinks he knows something, does not see it very plainly yet, and he doesn't know what he ought to know. Therefore, if our knowledge creates pride for us, it's better not to know anything. It's always the balancing act. We have to make sure that our knowledge does not bring pride. Because if it does, we are already on the wrong side. We need to be very careful about sharp judgment, as the brother already mentioned. And someone who feels differently and who or has freedom to act in a different way. So, some of the things that we learn from the words of Jesus and the things that matter, nobody even talks about them anymore. The very things that are going to be matter in eternity, the very questions that are going to be asked, no emphasis is being put on that. I was hungry, you fed me. I was thirsty, you gave me drink. All this stuff. This servant attitude that Jesus had and taught is, well, that requires too much of me. So therefore, I'll just revert to much words, much talk, much knowledge, much pride. Serious problem. We need to start thinking about people in this way, and then we'll begin to see ourselves and others in a different light. And that's what it's all about. We need to see that God had lots of patience with us. He brought us along. He suffered all those mixed up arrogant attitudes we had and whatnot. He didn't write us off. He didn't condemn us. He didn't ignore us. But patiently led us along, waiting for us. And I believe, you know, something that the Christian church is guilty of. Don't wait for those. And not knowing that they themselves were once like that. So if we just use the words of or the teaching of Jesus, we can then begin to extend that to someone else who is struggling and who is maybe not quite as free as we are. Because it created problems in the Corinthian church, it can still create problems today. Problems that can be dealt with in a more godly way. He says, not all possess this knowledge. And what do we do with weakness? Well, how are we supposed to act? Do we kick it in the face? Do we trample on it? Do we flaunt our strength? Show off our freedom? No, that's not what Paul is teaching. That's not what Paul is teaching. And a Christian view is towards the weak is to help. Not to put down. Not to make them feel rejected. Reach out. Meet them where they are. Help them along. Paul admonishes that we need to help those who are struggling in these areas. Because most of the time it's just a momentary indulgence, and is that so very important that we a lot of times break fellowship over? Is it so very important that we have that steak or that drink or whatever it is that offends so much our Christian brother? It is just a momentary indulgence, and it is not important. And the important thing is for a brother's growth. That's what important, to restrain ourselves. And for the sake of others. That's the gracious, godly Christian thing to do. And that is what love brings into the picture. So if we consider our influence upon others, weigh the facts, and that we want to do may not be so important after all. What we're trying to push through, what we're trying to do might not be so important. Compare that to maybe the danger that it could bring to someone else's spiritual life. We need to consider that as well. And it certainly has a bearing on how we act. How we act in public, whether we will flaunt our freedom or be gracious. So Paul says, if we do this when we know it will hurt somebody, that's the key point here. If we know it will hurt somebody in a spiritual walk, we are really sinning against Christ because we are doing this momentary satisfaction thing at the expense of a brother's spiritual welfare. But we need to be careful, because we can take this into the other ditch pretty far. The key here is if we injure somebody's faith. In many situations today, these arguments come up over things that are really just because somebody's feelings or prejudices are irritated. And in many situations, people, it's not a matter of somebody's going to lose their faith. It's not what it's about. It's about somebody's ideas being scoffed at or their prejudice being irritated. It's got nothing to do with growing in the Lord. Because they see somebody exercise the liberties that we have, yet they complain about it. Because they are annoyed and try to stop whatever it is that is happening. And just because people are offended is not a reason not to exercise the liberty, because they may actually be helped by it. And if that were true, Jesus shouldn't have done a lot of things that he did. Why did he go and irritate the Pharisees about the Sabbath, about so many things there? Why? Eating without washed hands, or going eating with sinners. Why should Jesus be limited to the Pharisees? That's the question. It is not what is meant here. It's not what Paul is trying to say here. Maybe if some of these things would happen, it might challenge the weaker one to rethink their reasoning or their limitations, and might have a chance for them to grow. Because great danger, I believe, great danger and great harm has been done to the church by trying to accommodate the behavior of Christians to the conscience of the lowest common denominator, so to say, the weakest brother in the church. We are to bring him up to level, and not everybody else, to bring everybody else down to the lowest and the weakest brother in the church. And I believe that is what's happening so many times, and the church cannot grow that way. That's not what Paul is talking about here. And that's just like saying, if I'm allergic to peanuts, does that mean that nobody else can have peanuts? That's the same argument. If something is not good for me, it's my problem, and I need to stay away from whatever it is that is a problem for me. If I have an addiction of alcohol, and I know that one drink will set me down that road, well, you better not touch it. If you have an addiction with porn, you better not go to any of these sites, because they put you in a tailspin. But not to say that there is anything good and that anybody can do that. But some of these things that we know that are not good for us, like if I said with these peanuts, you know, if you're not good for me, I can't have them. It doesn't matter, you can't have them. It doesn't mean that you can't have them. And Paul is clearly talking about someone who is going to be damaged by it when I do it. Therefore, and he says, if food is to cause my brother's falling, I will never eat meat, lest I cause my brother to fall. He's saying that's how serious it is. And I'm sure Paul didn't have a problem eating meat after this, even after knowing that some of them were offended by him doing it. So love is required. Self-control, self-discipline in these areas. Wisdom from God. When we can, when we can't. There's a little story of a Muslim who had converted to Christianity, and at a picnic, a girl brought a basket of sandwiches, and He asked him if he'd like to have some. And he said, what kind are they? What do you have? Oh, he said, I'm afraid we only have some, the ones left with pork. And he said, well, I'm afraid I'm not going to have any. And the girl says, knowing that he was already a Christian, said to him, well, sir, I am really surprised. Don't you know that as a Christian you are free from all these food restrictions? And that you can eat pork or ham or whatever, if you like. And he said, yes, I know that. I know I am free to eat pork, but I am also free not to eat it. I'm still involved with my family back east, and I know that when I go back home once a year and I come up to my father's door, the first question he's going to ask me is, have those infidels taught you to eat that filthy pork meat yet? And if I have to say to him, yes, Father, I will be banished from that home and have no further witness in it. But if I can say to him, I have always, as I have always been, no Father, no pork has ever passed my lips, then I will be admitted into that home and that family circle, and I can freely tell them of the joy I have found in Jesus Christ. Therefore, I am free to eat, or I am free not to eat, as the case may be. So here, he knew he could, he was allowed as a Christian to do it, but yet, because he wanted to witness to his family, and he knew he's going to ask them, so he chose not to because he didn't want to lie. And therefore, he said, no. Sometimes a Christian lacks this wisdom. And these are the situations that you run into. Is it all about me? Or is it about others? This little story sets the whole problem in perspective. And we don't have to have our rights. We don't have to exercise our rights. We are free to give them up at any time as the situation warrants, as the situation comes up. Though we have the right, we also have the right not to exercise them for the sake of love, for the sake of serving, for the sake of the gospel. So, for us, you know, we need to use wisdom. Paul says, all things are lawful for me. Everything is lawful for me, but all things are not edifying. Which goes well with this as well. So, we need to use wisdom when we encounter these situations, these problems, and I didn't even scratch the surface of all the issues that come up and what divides people, and it's usually because somebody is haughty and proud that things go like this. But if we are Christ-like, we can do a lot more and bring a lot more peace and maybe even understanding just by the way we act, the way we talk, the way we swallow our pride. So we had a very interesting chapter here. not something that that's just for eating of meat on titles, that's upper titles, but also a lot of different areas we can apply this principle. But in wisdom, there's two ways we can go, extreme one way or extreme the other. And the answer is somewhere in the middle. We don't cater to anybody who just doesn't like the way you wear your hat. Or even wear a hat at all. And mind you, I've lived through it. I have lived through that where a person wasn't wearing a hat and he was degraded to the worst of the worst. For what? Unbelievable. So, those are extremes that we can go into. Cater to everybody or cater to nobody. Let's have this wisdom. Make sure our heart is right in every situation. That's the most important thing. Make sure our heart is right. So very interesting chapter. And going back to this chapter 7, what I suggest is go home with your wife or your husband, read it over together. And there's some good marriage counseling in that as well. So God bless you. If the brothers would like to add a few words, gladly hear it.
Nothing to add, brothers. There's a lot of things that can be added to the message here today. There's a lot of where do I even start today? A lot of things were said by both brothers, and lots of food for thought. Lots of food for thought, brothers and sisters. And just commenting on Brother Ben's message here. Kind of goes together with what Brother Stephen said when he that is what would be called the least of the commands. That would be a least command. If meat make my brother to offend, I will eat no meat while the world standeth. Who has that kind of love? Who can deny himself that kind of liberty, just so that we can lift another one out of the gutter, or help those weaker ones in their journey? I'd like to turn your attention to, see, Romans chapter 14 is very similar to 1 Corinthians 8. It's almost identical. But I want to read Romans 15 rather than 14. It's after he had read Romans 14, after he had given those almost identical instructions here of if thy brother is grieved with thy meat, now walkest thou not charitably, and so forth here. And he starts the chapter 15 interestingly. He says, we then that are strong ought to bear the infirmities of the weak and not to please ourselves. Let every one of us please his neighbor for his good to edification. That takes years of deep Christian love to grow to be a Christian like that. And the Muslim illustration the brother had there was a good one. How did that man come to such an amazing? He saw immediately. He had the freedoms, but he chose to keep those Muslim commands just so he could minister back into his family. And there are so many parallels that we could apply here in our setting and in the church, that we have to decide, is this important enough to break fellowship, or is it? That's the decision we got to make. And then we need to, as it says, bear the infirmities of the weak and not the pleas of ourselves. Then we need to, yes, lower ourselves to those brothers or sisters who have those weaknesses, but not, like the brother also said, let that weakness wear down or drag down the whole church. Our job is to come down and bring them up. So not to forever cater to those weaknesses. Weaker brothers, gotta come up. Stronger brothers, gotta go down. And that way is how the church is elevated and lifted up. But first and foremost, unity is more important to God than my rights and my liberties. So you got to love what God loves and hate what God hates. And so that would be at least of the commands. And then there's another thing here, but like I said, this is more to this, this one part that Brother Ben has in, on 1 Corinthians 7:14. I think I have a revelation of that one. Interpretation or revelation or whatever you want. And it is indeed, it's a controversial word. And I've had a brother once tell me that, no, their children are shot. That they're born of godless families. And so I'm going to read the verse here. Just as a... I'm going to read this verse again here. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Else were your children unclean, but now are they holy. And in this context, we got to settle the first thing. There is no holy human being on the face of the earth. We're all sinners. We're born sinners. We grow up sinners. And we're sinners until saved by grace. And even then, when we're saved by grace, we're sinners. So what's he saying here? As for your children of unholy. I believe what he's saying here is when a child grows up in a home where there is one godly parent and the other one is ungodly, there is a huge opportunity for those children to receive the light of Jesus. Those children are growing up in an environment where there's light. One of the parents has the light of God on their lives. One of the parents is enlightened. So automatically there's light in that home. And what does light do? It influences. It influences, and sooner or later, seeds are sown in that child's heart. And sooner or later, God will honor the prayer of the mom. Or the prayer of the godly dad, and God will come through for those children. And I have to say this verse as in, God speaks of those things that are not as though they were. If you know what I'm saying here. So now are they holy? They're only holy because God, the light of God comes there, and when they turn to, and they have a greater chance to turn to Christ than those who grow up in a home with absolutely no spiritual light in it. They've got a very slim chance. That's my interpretation of that verse.